The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. Remember, keep the conversation going on Facebook at The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Thanks so much for listening. Is Turkey's coup in reruns? The fighting has stopped, but the government purges escalate. President Erdogan initiates more layoffs, including closing news organizations, 10,000 civil servants, 15 more media outlets, all laid off for their accused association with terrorist organizations, and the cleric Fethullah Gulen, who's been living in the United States and Pennsylvania for more than a decade. All told, more than 100,000 people have been let go, many of them military and government officials, intellectuals, journalists have been fired, suspended, 37,000 people have been arrested. Turkey is surrounded by battlefields and seems to be trying to seal itself off at this point. Tanks and troops have been massed near the border with Iraq. Attacks against U.S.-backed Kurds have escalated. There's a renewed level of security at the Syrian border as well. Family members at the U.S. consulate in Istanbul have been told to leave the country. Elliot Ackerman is a writer based in Istanbul. He's a contributor to The New Yorker, the author of the novel Green on Blue and the forthcoming novel Dark at the Crossing. He returned from Istanbul late last week, joins me now. Elliot, it's great to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
So what's it like over there right now? I mean, that's really the question.
Well, I think, you know, politically, it's obviously very, very tense. I think, you know, walking around the streets, you know, you don't necessarily feel it as much. But, you know, anyone who's in the Turkish intelligentsia, you know, they're under a lot of pressure right now. And there's a lot that's going unspoken. So it's tense.
Well, there's a long tradition in Turkey of people on the street just being blasé about what goes on beneath the surface or above their heads. But the closing of the latest newspaper has got to be a real shocker.
I think it is. And Çum Hürriyet, that newspaper, has really been
like the New York Times.
Right. I mean, it's been a bastion of sort of center-left, secular Turkish intellectual thought, you know, for decades and decades and decades. And that is something that Erdogan has positioned himself against. So going after Çum Hürriyet, you know, is significant on a lot of levels. And most significantly, Çum Hürriyet kind of ran afoul of Erdogan's administration when they revealed the story in 2015 that Erdogan's government was supporting Islamist rebels inside of Syria. And that just sort of started all of the pressure on them.
So Turkey has to hold because of the Iraq border, because of the Syrian border, really because it's the linchpin of the Middle East at this point, because Israel can't get involved. And, you know, their military is in cooperation with so many of the coalition partners.
Right. And Turkey is a byway for refugees who are heading into Europe. So political turmoil inside of Turkey is extremely bad for political stability in places as far-flung as Western Europe and the UK.
Has that threat ever been made? I mean, has Erdogan said, leave me alone or I'm going to pack all these refugees up and send them to, you know, Paris?
You know, there was a very interesting moment vis-a-vis the U.S., which is in June of 2015, there was an election in Turkey. And for the first time since 2002, Erdogan's AK Party failed to get a governing majority of the vote. And the reason they failed to get that governing majority was because the Kurdish party got 10% and was finally, for the first time ever, able to be seated in parliament. And immediately after that election, Erdogan's government went to the U.S. And for a long time, we had been pressuring him to put our jets into Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey to fly sorties into Syria, and he had refused us. Right after that election, he went to the U.S. and said, okay, you can have your jets in Incirlik Air Base. And then he immediately reopened the conflict with the Kurds in Turkey's southeast, and the U.S. basically said nothing. So as jets were launching – U.S. jets were launching out of Incirlik to bomb – ISIS positions inside of Syria and Iraq, those same jets, Turkish jets, were launching out of Incirlik to bomb the Kurds inside Turkey. So he has been very adept at leveraging leveraging the international community to get his way. And the reason he started that war in the southeast against the Kurds was because this Kurdish party that got 10% was threatening him because there was going to be a re-election in November. And when that re-election happened in November, there was now a war inside Turkey against the Kurds. and fewer people voted for that Kurdish party based off of that war. And then Erdogan was able to get the majority he needed in November of 2015 for his AK Party to once again take power. So he's been very astute.
Does Turkey have any piece of what's happening in Mosul right now? I mean, the Islamic State, the reports are just of absolute brutality taking place in Mosul as the fight escalates.
Well, I think Turkey would very much like to get more involved in what's going on in Iraq. One thing that really differs between Erdogan and previous heads of state is, you know, previous heads of state have really been anchored in this idea of Kemalism from Ataturk. And that's that the fundamentals of the Turkish Republic are secular. You know, Erdogan sees himself on an equal playing field as Ataturk. And his vision for the Turkish Republic is not one that's sort of been crippled by the after effects of the First World War. He sort of feels, and in his rhetoric shows, like those days are done. You know, we are no longer the Turks who came out of the First World War. We are the inheritors to this Ottoman legacy. That Ottoman legacy is one of empire. And so Erdogan,
dare we say caliphate,
and its own caliphate. So, you know, about 2 weeks ago, the Turkish government came out with a series of maps that basically showed Turkish influence. And if you looked at those maps, they spread into northern Syria and into Iraq. So the Turks, they haven't been as involved, but have been very keen to get involved into basically what is the redrawing of Iraq to places like the north and Mosul. So it's yet to be seen how they're going to exert their influence and to what end, but they're certainly paying close attention and looking for opportunities.
Elliot Ackerman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elliot Ackerman is a writer based in Istanbul. He's a contributor to The New Yorker, the author of the novel Green on Blue, and the forthcoming novel Dark at the Crossing. Does the UK have the wherewithal to be distracted by the US election with all their preoccupations with the exit from the European Union and the difficulty figuring out just what Prime Minister Theresa May plans to do about it? As part of our attempt to see our own election from outside the bubble in these last few days before the November 8th vote, we learned today that at least one UK analyst would only be too happy to think about the US and get some relief from British politics. Guido Harry is a political analyst and former spokesman for the former mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who is now, by the way, the UK's foreign secretary. Guido Harry says he's not the only one who's thrilled to get a break from Brexit and focus on Trump and Clinton.
The popular press have had a field day. They love colourful characters, and Donald Trump is about as colourful as they come. And there's been very inventive sort of coverage of even the sort of straight stuff before we got to the seedier stuff later on. You know, we had coverage here, one headline about Tom Hanks doing a satirical sketch, Forrest Trump. I've seen Miley Cyrus in the pages of the popular British press doing a very distinctive yoga pose, shall we say, with the headline, Kiss My Ashtanga, Donald Trump, or anyone who's prepared to vote for him. And then you've got things like Jeremy Corbyn's brother is backing Donald Trump. That is not something that recommends Donald Trump to the Sun readership, if you like, over here. That's another dig at him. But at the same time, they're not totally convinced by Hillary Clinton. There's a sense that she's been part of the establishment. There's a sense that Bill Clinton has been a little seedy. There's a sense there's a sort of gravy train here. But deep down, I think that the joke of Trump has now, you know, started to fall a little flat. There's an anxiety about what it'll mean.
So you've got the same problem at Saturday Night Live. When this election's over, they're not going to have any idea what to do.
I think what will happen in the UK is there will be quite a sense over here that this is a historical moment. At the moment, we're hearing a lot about how tired people are of Hillary, that she's just the old establishment. But of course, if she becomes the US president, she's not the old establishment. She's the first woman ever to occupy that office. And I think in the UK, certainly the intelligent, thoughtful press will note that milestone and will think that it's hugely significant. And they will draw parallels between her being in the White House, a female prime minister in number 10, the chancellor in Germany being a woman, and certain other things from the vice chancellor of Oxford University, for instance. There will be a narrative about how women are making progress in the world. So I think it will be seen as a significant historical moment. And there will be probably a lot of soul searching as to how somebody like Donald Trump got so close.
Trump has no friends in the UK, or people will come out of the woodwork?
I think he did have some friends. And, you know, I spent 4 years of my life looking after Boris Johnson, who was a very colourful character as mayor of London, who was, not out of central casting as the modern sort of polished politician oozing competence, but maybe a little dull. He was a colourful character and people liked that. And I think there was a craving early on to see something colourful like that happen in the US. And then Brexit has been a good sense check, if you like, because most of the establishment here called that one wrong, didn't quite see it coming, thought it might be close, but thought they would get away with it. And the fact that their instincts and indeed the polls and the analysis and the bets laid in the City of London Financial District all proved wrong means that people are humble enough now to think that this is a possibility and they're open to it. It may have changed over the last week or two, though, where it's not just a choice between a businessman and a political establishment woman. The feminine qualities of Hillary, I think, loom large now, as well as her experience, because she's up against a guy who over the last 2 weeks has disgusted a number of Republicans by not his policies so much, not even his pronouncements, but by aspects of his character that have come under intense scrutiny.
Guido Hare is a political analyst, former spokesman for the former London mayor, Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, of course, currently in the UK government right now, who would have to deal with all of these things. Guido Hare, thanks so much.
Thanks very much. Good to be on the program again.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Amid a swirl of headlines, with less than a week to go until Election Day, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are getting in their last-minute visits in the swing state of Ohio. As for the Senate race there, the state has been leaning red for quite some time. Republican incumbent Rob Portman maintains a sizable lead as he runs for a second term. His opponent, Democrat Ted Strickland, is looking to get back into a position of power. In 2010, you'll recall, he lost his re-election bid for governor to John Kasich by just 2 points. Karen Kassler is the State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio and Television. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi there.
So 60 Minutes a week ago or so had this just brokenhearted Ohio woman from, I think, the Columbus area, who was talking about how she wasn't going to vote for Trump on the national ticket, but was going to support Rob Portman, to maintain a Republican presence in the Senate. Is that how the votes are splitting, and is Portman looking safe at this point?
I think it's pretty safe to say Portman is looking safe. For a while, it looked like Ted Strickland, the former governor of Ohio, who, as you mentioned, had lost to John Kasich in 2010 by a very slim margin. He had come into the race with a lot of popularity, a lot of name recognition. He had been leading the polls for quite a while. That changed a couple months ago, and now Rob Portman has been maintaining a double-digit lead for the last couple of months. And some people have said that Portman is running just one of the best-run Senate campaigns in the country. This was a race that in Battleground, Ohio, was supposed to be one of the most expensive races in the country, one of the hottest races to watch because Ted Strickland and his popularity, Rob Portman and the Senate in the balance here. But it looks like at this moment in time, the polls are showing that Portman's walking away with it.
Do the polls also show that people are apparently going to split tickets, that Trump is having trouble where Portman is not, or is it just too close to call?
It's too close to call because Clinton has been leading in Ohio for a while, but by a very slim margin. And several polls right now have Trump up a little bit. But, you know, we're watching some of those polls in terms of how heavily they're weighting Republicans and Democrats. But I think the ticket splitting phenomenon is very interesting here because what we have in Ohio now going into this race is more registered and affiliated Republicans in Ohio than we had in a long time, because a lot of people in the primary voted for John Kasich. They pulled a Republican ballot to vote for John Kasich. And so there are a lot of registered Republicans, so to speak, who are now out there. And whether they will vote Republican this fall is a real question. But certainly there are a lot more Republicans than there are Democrats, at least on paper in Ohio.
Is this an outside money phenomenon here in Ohio?
Oh, absolutely. There's been a lot of money in this race. It was, like I said, thought to be one of the most expensive races. It was going to be the big marquee race to watch. That's changed a bit, but not before there was tens of millions of dollars that were poured into this campaign, not only by the candidates themselves. And Rob Portman has definitely outspent Ted Strickland. He came into this race with a lot more money. He's raised a lot more money, and he certainly spent a lot more money. But then there's also outside forces that have gotten involved, people who have been running ads for Rob Portman. Portman and against Ted Strickland, we're talking $40 million at least.
Karen Kassler is State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio and Television. In California, the national election is just not that interesting. With the state solidly Democratic, the only chance Californians might have to see Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is if some candidate plane had mechanical difficulty and was forced to land on the way to Nevada or Colorado or New Mexico or some state that's in play. Fortunately, there are all kinds of ballot measures in California this year. Marisa Lagos is KQED's California government and politics reporter. She says Proposition 61 has become the costliest ballot fight in California's history, thanks to the deep pockets of the pharma industry.
This is a ballot measure. It's kind of a little wonky. It would tie prescription drug prices for public insurance programs like our Medicare program in California to what the VA pays for drug prices. So the idea is essentially to make it so the state's not paying more than the federal government for prescription drugs. I kind of compare it to the soda tax. We've seen a lot of these in cities in California in recent years. And does Coca-Cola really care if Berkeley, California has a soda tax? Probably not as much in terms of their bottom line. But what they do care about is if other cities and states get that idea. And I think that's what we're seeing here. I mean, there's a lot of warnings about the practical implications of this, but I don't think we really know what they would be other than sort of a political statement by the voters.
There are debating or competing ballot measures in any case on the death penalty in California this time around. How does that work exactly?
So 62 would repeal the death penalty entirely and replace it with life without parole. 66 is sort of seeking to speed up our process here. We've had over 10 years with no executions in California, you know, still with 700 people on death row here. So it is definitely a huge issue. Basically, neither one of them is polling very well. So it's entirely possible they both fail and we, you know, stay with the status quo. But if they were to both pass, we would see the one with the most votes take the wind, so to speak.
The NRA has a dog in the fight in one of these ballot measures. California wants to increase its already strict gun control laws, or at least an initiative would do that.
Yeah, so this is Prop 63. This is actually put on the ballot by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who is a rising star in the Democratic Party, you could say. The state is looking to regulate ammunition very similarly to the way we regulate guns sales right now. It is definitely seen by gun control advocates as sort of the new front in this big fight. Interestingly, the NRA hasn't spent a lot of money on this one. I think they looked at the polls and probably saw that it looked pretty likely to pass. I've heard some people say maybe they're just saving their money for a court challenge. It is polling fairly well. I think voters in California have been a lot more receptive to gun control than our legislature has, where maybe money plays a little differently. So I think it's going to be kind of fascinating to see how this rolls out. And again, like what happens in court if it does pass.
Did we actually get to all 17 measures?
Not even close. we missed school bonds and revenue bonds and tax hikes.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you after Election Day. Marisa totally. Lagos is KQED's California government and politics reporter. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Are you a Californian still confused about the measures? KQED has a good, unbiased guide for the election. You can find a link on our site, thetakeaway.org.
This is Jennifer in Portland, Oregon, and a friend's daughter who recently graduated from an international university in Malaysia said that those students that she knew who had been planning to go to universities in the United States decided not to once Trump became the GOP nominee. They worried about harassment as foreign students.
Well, all you outsiders, tell us the story of what your folks and friends from outside the border are thinking about this election. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MINE-TAKE, or post a comment to thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A police shooting near Des Moines, Iowa, early this morning. Two officers were killed, allegedly by a suspect now in custody, a middle-aged man by the name of Scott Michael Green. He's white, and that's one of the few confirmed details in this case.
It doesn't look like there was any interaction between these officers and whoever the coward is that shot him while they sat in their cars. That's the best we got that we can explain the scene right now.
It's Police Sergeant Paul Parizak. Spokesman at a news conference earlier today, the incident has closed schools in the Des Moines suburb of Urbandale and canceled a Clinton campaign event scheduled for today. Clay Masters is the Morning Edition host and a reporter for Iowa Public Radio. He's been covering the story. Clay, how on edge is the community right now?
Well, the community is pretty on edge. As you said, they have taken into custody 46-year-old Scott Michael Green. He's a white male. He was located west of Des Moines in Iowa's Dallas County by the Dallas County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa State Patrol. They have him in custody right now. They're going to be questioning him, and they did identify the officers in a press conference today. Urbandale, which is a suburb of Des Moines, Officer Justin Martin was the first officer killed, as well as Des Moines Police Officer Anthony or Tony Bimineo.
Does this appear to be connected to any sort of confrontation with police in the Des Moines area? Does this Mr. Green have any context for this shooting?
Well, Urbandale police have issued trespass issues to Green in the past. He's threatened to sue Urbandale schools. There is a video out there that many news organizations, it's a YouTube account that is linked to Green, where he was kicked out of a high school football game last month, claiming his civil rights were violated when he was asked to leave the school's property for displaying a Confederate flag while in the stands. Now, this I haven't seen if this has been completely confirmed, but there are a lot of fingers pointing to this YouTube video that has surfaced out there.
But that YouTube video doesn't affiliate him with a particular movement that would be associated with Confederate flags in Iowa or armed militia.
No, this is an isolated incident.
And given that it is an isolated incident, what are police doing to, attempt to, you know, keep security? I know that schools are closed, and I know a campaign event was canceled, but there's no indication that this had anything to do with the campaign.
No, and the police department is saying that this man acted alone. Just to go over what happened again, it was just after 1 o'clock in the morning that shots were fired in Urbandale and police officers were called. The first officer was found shot to death in his police cruiser. This is near that high school that we just mentioned, and this is a small suburb. And about 20 minutes later, another officer, this time a Des Moines police officer, was shot and killed in a patrol car. And while they're two different communities, these killings happened about 2 miles apart. In this neighborhood, it's a mainly residential neighborhood. Both of the shootings happened on some pretty well-traveled main roads in Urbandale and Des Moines.
And so based on those circumstances you just told me, there was a period of time when this fellow was walking on the streets of Urbandale with a gun.
Yeah, and he was apprehended driving away, and this was he was caught in the next county to the west. So still awaiting details on further information about that.
Clay Masters is Morning Edition host and a reporter for Iowa Public Radio. He's been covering the story of a police shooting, two officers dead, in a suburb of Des Moines. Clay, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
We are going to focus on many of the issues that voters tell us are most important. Jobs.
Law and order.
Climate change.
Social security.
This next question comes from the public.
The biggest tax cuts.
Your schools are no good.
Immigration. How can you unite a country?
Income inequality.
You have no job.
Gross national debt.
Pre-existing conditions.
Race.
You're living in poverty.
Uncertain issues.
Too much inequality.
Cyber attack.
Deportation.
The Supreme Court.
Discipline.
Let me repeat the question.
Okay.
So, let's begin.
It's a challenge every election cycle. How do you slice up the American electorate into groups that have meaning if you look at specific issues? Is there a way to really see how issues affect Americans in different communities? Answering this question is the mission of the American Communities Project that has divided the country into 15 distinct communities. Using these categories as a guide and a little of our own reporting, we've been pursuing an initiative we're calling Portrait of an American Voter. We're hearing your thoughts and concerns about the challenges facing our nation. It's not a scientific poll. It's more a personal, emotional exploration of how individual voters are making up their minds on issues from education and the environment to police brutality and PTSD. Up next, here's a voter in the Native American lands community type.
My name is Vernon Miller, and I am 39 years old, and I serve as the tribal chairman for the Omaha Tribe of Nebraska and Iowa. In my capacity as tribal chairman, I've really seen a plethora of issues. I used to be a high school teacher. Our tribe is getting younger, so we really need to respond to that. So 50% of the Omaha tribe is 18 years of age or younger. You know, a lot of our elders, unfortunately, are passing on a lot sooner, and with our elders leaving, we're seeing a loss of the language a lot more rapidly than we expected. Each of the schools on the reservations, there's four schools in Nebraska specifically that are predominantly Native. Predominantly all the staff are non-Native. You know, I always promote the profession of education because I don't see any reason why our schools and the staff that are there aren't truly reflective of the entire student body. So you see some funding disparities there too, because in education in schools, they're based off property taxes. And in reservations, since you can't assess a property tax, that really is a disparity in how their schools are funded. So when I first became a teacher in 2005, I chose to student teach at Omaha Nation. So when I came here as a business teacher, one of the courses that you teach is obviously teaching our students computer applications or, you know, information technology classes. But unfortunately, we didn't have any computers when I became a teacher here, you know, a student teacher here. That's just an example of how there's a huge disparity in funding. It was very commonplace to have textbooks that were 20, you know, years old, 10 years old, 15 years old. And it wasn't uncommon to only have a couple in the classroom. So you had to really be flexible and creative with how you were able to do any type of instruction with the limited resources. I really want to, you know, start a mentoring program, start a youth council that can start addressing some of these youth issues from their perspective and only the lens that they could bring to that discussion. You know, we deal with issues here from truancy to issues of, you know, juvenile crime, you know, even with suicide, you know, how can our youth, how do they want to deal with it? You know, it's one thing for adults to really, you know, mandate something, but I really want to hear from the youth, and giving those issues to our youth and letting them discuss it and them come up with solutions. And then we, as the tribal council, take their, you know, recommendations and act on it from that standpoint.
To hear all 15 voices featured in our Portrait of an American Voter project, head over to thetakeaway.org/voter. Pipeline, a nation that considers domestic oil and gas a national security issue, and a river considered sacred by another nation, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which opposes valuing oil and gas resources above all else. It believes existing treaties require that they have a seat at the table to decide if and when and where a pipeline should be built. The pipeline plans to extend over four states, cover 1,172 miles. It will be carrying 400,000 barrels of crude a day if that pipeline is completed. We've been covering this story for weeks. Sarah Manning is a columnist and contributing writer at Indian Country Today Media Network. She witnessed confrontations last week between tribal groups and law enforcement in a number of states.
Unarmed water protectors suffered mace, tear gas grenades, rubber bullets, beanbag shots, deafening sirens, police batons, and the utter psychological distress of being surrounded by hundreds of police in riot gear that day. Horsemen and their horses were also shot at, and one horse was put down after being shot at and traumatized by the event.
Sarah Manning, columnist and contributing writer at Indian Country Today Media Network. Craig Stevens is a spokesperson for the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now, a coalition that supports the construction and operation of that Dakota Access Pipeline.
Right now, what is happening is, as the construction continues on the bulk of the pipeline, and in fact, right now it is about 77% completed, a cost of $3 billion, where the company is waiting on the final easement under Lake Oahe, which is about 1,000 feet for the final stretch of that pipeline. There is a lot of discussion and, to use your word, conflict going on out there. And I think that it is elevated and escalated to a point where a lot of folks are frankly uncomfortable with the level of that discourse and conflict. At the end of the day, the Native Americans and the protesters are trespassing on private lands. And I think that's where this actually gets down to the crux of it.
Right, but that doesn't speak to the question of prior to the ownership by the rancher, what the status of the land is, which is part of the conflict right now.
Well, again, the Supreme Court has ruled on that. It has been adjudicated, and the Supreme Court ruled on it. And you know, back in the 19th century, that the Congress actually acted on that also. So, you know, this is not a time to relitigate that. This is a time to actually move forward with the current laws and regulations.
Although the Native Americans would say, in fact, this is the time to rethink injustices that go back to the 1800s, and that is in fact what this is all about. And to pretend that that doesn't exist only exacerbates the claims and sense of outrage of those folks.
Well, John, we live in a civil society, right? We live in a country that's ruled by the Constitution, by laws and regulations, and you know those regulations allow us to live in harmony and in a civil society. These regulations have been on the books about the regulations specifically about how to bring about a pipeline have been on the books for decades. And without this, without actually respect for the law and respect for regulations, you know, our infrastructure, our economy, and our lives as we know it cannot move forward.
The question from the standpoint of the Native Americans is the sacred aspect of the land from their point of view underneath the Missouri River. And that's where the easement stops you from extending the pipeline underneath the waterway. The Department of Interior supports the holding of that easement right now. What's your view?
Well, right now, so you mentioned the Department of the Interior. I mean, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Justice, and the Secretary of the Army actually did put a pause on the granting of that easement, although the local Army Corps of Engineers did issue a memo suggesting and actually agreeing that the easement should move forward. But, you know, where we are is where we are. But with regards to the land under Lake Oahe, there's already a natural gas pipeline that goes under there. And, you know, even this entire route that's currently under dispute is home to a natural gas pipeline and an electrical transmission wire. So, you know, this particular route was chosen to be co-located with these energy infrastructure projects so as to mitigate and minimize any threats to cultural or environmentally sensitive areas.
You know, this idea that this isn't something new, do you see how offensive that is to tribes who say, something new, nothing? It's like we weren't in a position to fight this, but we're in a position to fight it now. I mean, you know, the slaves didn't fight slavery until, you know, we got to the 1800s. In other words, you can't pick the time to say justice needs to be done. That's their view. And the second thing is, with oil prices at this level, why not wait?
Well, first of all, I didn't mean to be offensive, and when I was referring to not being new, the actual engineering and construction of pipelines is not new. With regards to the oil pipeline, you know, our country uses 19 million barrels of crude a day. That's 800 million gallons.
Sure.
And we're going to need that fuel for the foreseeable future. And where we get that is going to be ultimately what our decision to make, whether we're going to get that from the United States or going to get that from other countries. And if you look at pipelines, they're also much less carbon intensive than other forms of shipping, whether that's rail, by barge, or by truck. And it's more cost effective. So, and also considering the amount of time that it takes to build any of these infrastructure projects, I mean, we're at 800 days already just for this one pipeline that has been under consideration, gone through reviews, gone through approvals, and ultimately construction. So it takes a lot of time to build these infrastructure projects. So it's not a matter of making a decision, turning on a switch, and having it done tomorrow.
No, I understand. And I don't want anyone to go bankrupt over this. But, I mean, isn't the domestic tranquility in the United States worth something, given that you could get the oil from Nigeria or Mexico for at least some interim period while you resolve this?
Well, as you know, the oil is actually sold and bought on a global market. And this actual pipeline doesn't stop any flow from the Bakken Formation. What it does is actually supplant the need for rail cars. And, you know, right now there are 700 rail cars that go within 2 miles of the Standing Rock Sioux's water intake. You know, that's much more carbon intensive. It's also much more dangerous and much more likely of a spill. So a pipeline is by far the safest mode of transportation for petroleum products. And I think, you know, we're at a point where we're 1,000 feet is separating us from the finish line. And it's, I think, quite frustrating for everybody.
Have you made this argument to the Standing Rock tribe that you're making to me right now?
I'm sure the company is in consultation with the tribe.
You sure about that?
It's been reported.
All I'm saying is, like, you shouldn't be talking to me. You should be talking to them. That's all that they're asking for.
Yeah, and again, I believe that the company is, and the U.S. government has laid out in Judge Boasberg's decision, attempted, you know, more than a dozen times, and were rebuffed.
Craig Stevens, spokesperson for the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now, a coalition that supports the construction and operation of the Dakota Access Pipeline. As you can hear, a very frustrated situation for a man whose construction and project has been held up for how long now?
Well, the project continues to be built, but it's now been about 54 days since the federal government said they're going to hold on the easement under Lake Oahe.
Craig, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Well, on this World Series day, we couldn't have an Ohio voice without having a Chicago voice as well. We spoke with Nick Cave. He's a visual artist based in Chicago who tries to bend meaning in his work. His famous sound suits use a compelling but primitive form of virtual reality to allow performers to step inside the suits and create noise through expressive movements. It's all a way of allowing people to see a different point of view. His newest installation, Until, Cave chose to use a vast exhibition space with thousands of objects he rescued from flea markets and sidewalk sales. Some of his favorite objects are filled with racial meaning from bygone days that he resurrects in his work to reenlist them as soldiers in a battle to reclaim history. Until opened last month in North Adams, Massachusetts, in a massive museum made from an old factory that is itself a reclamation of history.
The show opens up as you enter the space, which is the size of a football stadium. You will enter this sort of vast field of about 16,000 wind spinners that are moving in the sort of circular sort of motion, two stories tall. And these wind spinners are just traditional ones that, you know, have butterflies and birds and flowers on them. But then there's a selection of custom ones that are guns, targets, teardrops, bullets. And so that is sort of mixed within this sort of ready-made sort of object that really sort of creates this sort of fantastical sort of sensation. The moment that you walk in, you're just completely transformed. And then you're able to climb up these ladders into this sort of forbidden garden. And then within the terrain are about 17 lawn jockeys that are existing within this environment, holding these amazing dream catchers.
Tell me about the name Until, and is there going to be a improvisational performance element to the installation at Mass MoCA, as there has been with a lot of your work?
The title Until really sort of comes from, you know, innocent until proven guilty, or guilty until proven innocent. That's how we sort of came to the title. But the project also, within this space, there's about two or three different locations for convenings. May it be civic leaders that come together and sort of have a meeting under the crystal cloudscape and talk about issues of race, gun violence within their communities, not only sort of racial profiling, but it's, you know, all of these sort of unarmed black men that have been shot within the last year. It's over 300 incidents. So for me, it's very frightening to think that, you know, I don't have the sort of luxury of just sort of walking down the street at night without thinking about, you know, where I'm at and how that could sort of shift in a matter of seconds.
Do the lawn jockeys haunt you? Do they have the power that they originally had when you first started working with them?
No. You know, they empower me. Of course, I know the sort of connotations that sort of come along with that object. But, you know, I'm also have shifted their sort of position within this work. You know, they are normally sort of standing with a lantern in their hand. So it's really the sort of subservient position. But now they have this amazing dream catcher that they're holding above their heads. And it just sort of creates this sort of sense of independence. You know, there's a relevancy that sort of comes into play, a sense of freedom. These objects exist in the world. I'm at flea markets regularly and all over the world. And so it's not that they don't, they aren't there, as well as other sort of consumer racism related objects are. But it's really me sort of taking sort of a responsible position and renegotiating how can we sort of now look at these objects in a different way.
What's the most racially charged object you've ever found at a flea market that really explicitly evoked a history that we don't want to visit?
My last show at Jack Shaman Gallery in New York was titled Made by Whites for Whites. And it was a show based on, I found this, it was a bust of a black man's head. And I thought it was interesting. And so I took it down off the shelf and I read it, read the label, and it said a spittoon. And I just went into like the state of like shock.
Wow.
And then that was the beginning of me looking for the most repressive, most sort of disgusting, despairing, horrific objects.
You're running away from the idea of a big bonfire to get rid of them all. It's a more heroic leap to de-vulgarize them than to destroy them.
Yes, and that, you know, I'm not interested in shying away and sort of turning my back on, you know, these things that have been created to, for me, I sort of see them as the sort of form of commercial sort of racial product that was produced to sort of keep us in our place or to let us know what our place is within society. And so, you know, I'm interested in that. It's the fuel that sort of gets me fired up.
Nick Cave is an artist whose current installation, Until, can be seen at Mass MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Adams, Massachusetts, through next fall. Nick, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
No matter who wins the election, one thing will end in 2016 and 2017, Barack Obama's Twitter handle. The first Twitter handle in chief, at POTUS, P-O-T-U-S, will be handed over to the new president in a formal ceremony as specified in the Constitution in a rarely invoked clause of the 22nd Amendment. I'm kidding, of course, but the passing of the Twitter handle is real, and the National Archives and Records Department says the Obama tweets will join the nation's archives by migrating to at POTUS44 on January 20th, and the 11 million followers to the president's Twitter account will remain followers and can actually watch the transfer happen on January 20th, the day of the inauguration. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.